For those of us who are parents, we all dread those times when our children come to us in pain. We've all had to comfort our young ones when they've had stomach aches, for example. But what about those times when the pain is more severe or when nothing else seems to help? I'm Kermit Poling, and on tonight's Health Matters, we're joined by Dr. Sunny Hussain. Dr. Hussain is a pediatric gastroenterologist with Willis-Knighton Pediatric Gastroenterology and Research and clinical associate professor of pediatrics for LSU Health Science Center in Shreveport. He's a contributing author to the Nelson Textbook of Pediatrics, 18th edition, and to the book Reflux Disease Causes, Symptoms, and Treatment, published by Nova. Also joining us is Carrie Gaskin, registered nurse and clinical research manager at the Willis-Knighton Physician Network. And Dr. Hussain, Carrie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Dr. Hussain, we'll start with something that you're very much specialized in, and it's also a topic that I think most of us as adults are at least familiar with, and that's gastroesophageal reflux disease, which most of us know as GERD. And I think most of us have seen the advertisement for the little purple pills and all of that. But it's not just an adult disease. I think a lot of us tend to think of it that way, because apparently children, including babies, also suffer with GERD. So you can start first, if you would, by just explaining what GERD is.
We all know what GERD is when the contents of the stomach, especially the acid, pops back into the esophagus, which is the food pipe, which is often a physiological thing. I mean, it happens to all of us. I mean, that's how we burp, and we need to do that. But when it happens beyond a normal range in excessive amount, it becomes pathological, which is not good for us. And then we call it gastroesophageal reflux disease, called GERD. On the other hand, GER, or gastroesophageal reflux, is just a physiological phenomenon. Now, the GERD, or gastroesophageal reflux disease, can happen both in little children and as well as in adults. Mm-hmm. But it's the natural history and pathophysiology is very different in little children and babies versus the adults. The fundamental notion is, if as an adult person you have gastroesophageal reflux disease, which is symptomatic and troublesome, you need to be treated with medications. In little babies, when they get reflux disease, they cry, they speed up. But the main difference is that most of the babies, they grow out of it when they become about 1 year of age. How good Lord does it, we don't know, but he does it. So that's why it is very important that what intervention we do, medical versus surgical versus non-pharmacological, we need to carefully consider that, and they have implications both short-term and long-term.
All right. For those of you who have questions about GERD, or for any other gastroesophageal problems, perhaps, that you may have questions for your children, give us a call at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502, because we are welcoming your questions this evening. When you're dealing with an adult, I think it's pretty straightforward to ask questions and get a response that well, maybe sometimes at least makes sense. But that's got to be, I think, more difficult with children. How do you manage to diagnose this with children, especially babies?
Right. The diagnosis for gastroesophageal reflux disease in children is pretty much clinical. And there's a little difference between little babies and older children. The little babies, they cry. You know, mm-hmm. They speed up. They are fussy. They are irritable. They don't sleep very well. They don't feed very well. And pretty much the parents will be not very happy with their baby, and they will go to the doctors. And different medications are tried. And when even sometimes the formula are changed, and when nothing happens, we are stuck with the problem, and we know that the baby has reflux disease. Babies can talk, but they can cry. The older children, they throw up. They throw up. They have abdominal pain, and their quality of life it seems very obvious that they're not happy. They're not doing well in the school. They don't like to play. So it's slightly different, but in both cases, the fundamental pathologic problem is the acid in the stomach, which pops back in the food pipe and bother the kids.
So it's also an issue where the symptoms go on for a longer period of time, because all children at one form and one time or another, they're going to throw up or they're not going to feel well. When has it been long enough for a parent to get concerned and start looking at something more?
I think the main difference is when to treat and when not to treat. When the quality of life is compromised, say a baby is crying all the time, not feeding well, not gaining weight, versus an older child who's not playing, being miserable, throwing up. And that's the time we need to draw a line that this gastroesophageal reflux disease needs medical attention.
All right. I'm joined by Dr. Sunny Hussain, a pediatric gastroenterologist, and Carrie Gaskin, who is clinical research manager at the Willis-Knighton Physician Network. And we welcome your calls. Call now at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. We'll get you on the air just as soon as we can. When you diagnose an infant in particular with GERD, what then is your next step? How do you treat that?
Once a diagnosis is made, which I said is pretty much a clinical diagnosis, one of the main differential diagnoses is to rule out that there's nothing underlying sinister, like a kinking of the small bowel, we call it malrotation, or a blockage of the stomach, we call it pyloric stenosis. And this can be done by a simple radiological X-ray called upper GI, which can be done in any local hospital by any competent radiologist. What basically the babies or the kids do, they swallow a little bit of contrast called barium, and the radiologist tracks it down in its way down through the stomach. And if there's a blockage or a kinking, they can figure it out, and we can basically take care of it. These surgical diagnoses, when they are excluded, it becomes a pure gastroesophageal reflux disease, and we know, depending on the symptoms, that they need to be treated. Now, the first-line medications are basically over-the-counter. You know about Zantac, which is a H2 antagonist, Pepcid, and a number of them are available. And the second line is now widely available. We call it PPI, or the proton pump inhibitors, which are, you know, widely advertised, Prilosec, Nexium, and that second category of medications.
All right. You mentioned also earlier that sometimes babies just outgrow this. How frequently does that happen?
This is fascinating, that babies outgrow gastroesophageal reflux disease in more than 95% cases. Mm-hmm. That is awesome. And as I said, that good Lord sort of, helps the babies to grow. At the same time, when they grow, their muscle in the esophagus gets stronger, the valve gets stronger, and also when they stand up, the gravity helps them to get the milk down instead of popping back. So basically, 95% of the babies, they grow out of it. As a physician, our job is to make that transition smooth, not do an intervention which is too drastic, not surgeries very often, but just to make that transition smooth, that the nature can take care of it, and the babies just get better on their own.
All right, we have our first caller. This is Charles from Logansport, Louisiana. Charles, thank you so much for waiting. And what's your question?
I was concerned about my wife. She has acid reflux and has had a problem for many years. And I was just wondering about, any newer medicines that could be used, and it also causes sinus passage and bronchitis infection, and just wondered if there's any, new information out pertaining.
Charles, may I ask how long it's been going on? Your wife has been reflux. How many years?
It's been, several years. I'd say maybe 10 years. Okay. I'd say probably 10 years.
Okay, let me tell you this. What happens is if an adult person has acid reflux for that long, there could be a change in the lower part of the esophagus from the chronic acid exposure. It's called Barrett's esophagus. It's a precancerous thing. So you need to be a little careful about it, that I'm sure you have tried a number of medications, I guess, over the last 10 years. And if the GERD hasn't gotten better, probably you need to see a gastroenterologist who can evaluate what's going on exactly with your wife. And probably at this point, an endoscopy is necessary to make sure that we don't have a Barrett's esophagus, which is a precancerous condition. That's what I would do.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, Charles.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Thank you for your call. And we have a an online question that came through, so I'm going to read this one as well. And this one is someone that is referring back to their childhood. They're wanting to know what went wrong when they were a kid. I was born in 1956, he says, and as told by my mother and grandmother, almost died 4 months after my birth due to gastritis. He had a high fever and enemas could not aid in moving his bowels. Since I am suffering from ulcerative colitis, through regular colonoscopies and oral medication, he has the inflammation under control. But his question was, what happened just after birth that's the root cause for the ulcerative colitis?
There's no genetic reason for having ulcerative colitis. We don't have any gene or a single factor isolated for ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, which are known as inflammatory bowel disease or IBDs. Pretty much the certain people, they have a makeup being vulnerable to their own immune system when the immune system starts acting up against their own GI tract. And when at that point, if it acts against the colon, you get the colitis. Now, we have seen that if you have a family history of colitis, you have a higher chance of getting it. Also, it's fascinating to see that colitis is a disease of developed countries. You see in North America, you see it in Europe, but it is hardly seen in Africa or Asia, where the enteric infection like diarrheal diseases are very prevalent. So we jokingly say that sanitation has a price to pay. I mean, it's fascinating to see that in African continent, there's hardly any colitis, but colitis is one of the, is very prevalent in African Americans. And actually, when the African Americans get colitis or Crohn's disease, they get actually the bad form of the disease. To answer your questions in short, I don't think anything happened when you were little or around the birth time, which has caused your ulcerative colitis. That I can assure you. There's no scientific evidence for that.
All right, you're listening to Health Matters. My guests are Dr. Sunny Hussain. Sunny is a pediatric gastroenterologist. See, I have trouble with that one, too. Can you find a shorter term for that? He's also a clinical associate professor of pediatrics for LSU Health Science Center in Shreveport. Carrie Gaskin, who is a little quiet right now, but she's a registered nurse and also the clinical research manager at the Willis-Knighton Physician Network. And I know we'll talk a little bit about the research that you're working on a little later, but we do have our next guest. This is Raymond. Raymond, thank you so much for calling this evening. What's your question?
Hey, guys, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
A few years ago, I underwent, and excuse me if I don't get the terminology correct, a fundoplication. I had, a severe case of, GERD. And, apparently, what they determined was that the lower part of my esophagus had deteriorated to the point that the little valve down at the bottom of it had, dissolved. So what they had to do was they had to cut that part, the part off, and do what the doctor called, 170 degree, tie off of the remaining part of my esophagus. And that was a horrible, painful surgery. I mean, it was done
laparoscopically.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, should a baby have to go through that? How in the world
would an
infant, have to deal with something? In order to cough, I had to lay down on the bed and push all of my weight against pillows and stuff just in order to cough. And how would that affect a child or a baby, I'll shut down. I know what I went through as an adult, and it was not fun.
Right. What you went through is called Nissen fundoplication. It's actually a whole wrap, like a stitch around the top of your stomach. It's called fundus of the stomach. Now, the Nissen fundoplication is kind of a surgical treatment as a last resort for reflux disease. But increasingly what we are seeing that it's been used, especially in children and often in small babies, as an easy fix to fix the gastroesophageal reflux disease, which is my enormous personal concern. And I have dedicated myself to create awareness against it. The first Nissen fundoplication in children was done in 1991 by laparoscopic fundoplication, which you have gone through. And the reasons we were using that when the babies were vomiting a lot, we were trying to fix it so that they can't vomit anymore. But in the subsequent years, especially in the sort of, you know, rest of the 1990s, we have found that what a horrible effect the Nissen fundoplication has created on the stomach motility. These kids cannot burp anymore. They cannot throw up anymore. They're bloated. They cry all the time. Some of them get better, but this surgery is overdone, and it has created a nationwide concern now that we are really overdoing this surgery. Thank you for bringing up this, particularly sensitive topic, because, you know, between the doctors, we don't want to talk about what other doctors do, but this particular thing, especially when the babies, 95% of them get better anyway with medical treatment, why rushing the surgery? There's one scenario, we call it apnea, when babies kind of stop breathing because of the reflux, or reflux is blamed for the apnea. A young mother takes her baby to the emergency room, and basically the baby gets admitted in the hospital. And people look for an easy fix. And also, when the parents are scared, they want something done that it doesn't happen again. I think instead of investigating the apnea, where reflux is not the commonest cause for apnea, there are so many other things. Even a viral infection can cause it. Even a heart problem can cause it. Overfeeding can cause it. And initiating the medical treatment can resolve most of this. Nissen fundoplication, this surgery, which you have gone through, is often done. The problem is babies cannot speak. We speak for them. The parents speak for them and make a decision. And many years we didn't know about this horrible effects of Nissen fundoplication. And when we started doing the lap band surgery in adults for obesity, then we heard what happens. It's kind of the same thing. You put a stitcher on the stomach in babies or children or any other sort of person, and then you have a abnormal movement of your stomach. You are bloated all the time. You can't burp. You can't throw up. So exactly that's what you're going through. But that's why what I personally believe that only selective cases where medical treatment has completely failed, this Nissen fundoplication should be done, or it should be done only when it's a life-saving surgery. But thanks for bringing it up.
You're listening to Health Matters. The number to call with your question is 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. Primarily, we're discussing gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, in children. And you are welcome to call my guests, Dr. Sunny Hussain and also Carrie Gaskin. And I do have a question for you then, since obviously parents would hear about surgeries and obviously there's a rush on surgeries, even as you say, 95% of babies outgrow this. What do you tell the parents to console them or encourage them so that they won't necessarily jump at a surgical treatment?
I think always a second opinion is helpful, that mm-hmm. when they are talked about a surgery, you're putting a stitch around your baby's stomach. Seeking a second opinion. If you can't get it locally, you can go to a children's hospital nearby, or seeking an opinion from a gastroenterologist or a different surgeon or your own pediatrician helps a lot. Or you can do your own reading going online. I mean, this is all available nowadays. So I guess question when you are given a decision by a doctor that why you're doing this, what are the side effects, and is there any other way out? Is there any alternative therapy? Is there any other medications we use? I mean, this is what we are going to come to our clinical trial, which our research director, Carrie Gaskin, leads, that we have newer medications coming, you know, every year, and they are much more effective. Say, if we go back 15 years, we didn't have so effective medications we have these days now. Say, for example, in our clinical trial, which we are doing right now, we have about more than 15 kids who were desperate. if we didn't have this trial, they will probably end up having surgeries. Now they have sought kind of, you know, desperate help, and we have put them on the trial, and Ms. Kerry Gaskin can put some light on that, how well they have been doing. So, Kerry, you want to take a lead on that?
Yes. So far, the children are doing really well. The drug we're looking at is Acifex. It's currently approved for children over the age of 16. And with this therapy, the children are able to get it at the infant age of 1 to 11 months old. So far, the patients have done very well. It's a 10-week trial. Everything that the trial is doing is it's all driven by patient symptoms. The parents fill out a diary every day reporting the patient symptoms, the episodes of reflux, how many times, how many episodes, the extent of it. And that's how the drug is driven as far as their dosage.
What qualifies them in particular for this type of a treatment, this type of a study? Is it the severity? Is it the length of time that they've had the problem?
Again, most of it's driven by what the parent reports to us, their symptoms. Because besides diagnosing GERD by clinical symptoms, you don't know the severity except what you're reported to by the parent.
Right.
Arching of the back when they try to eat. Failure to thrive. Now, we can see that because we can look at the weight and the growth curve of the children. But we look at, you know, the patient symptoms, how often they're spitting up, the severity of their crying at night, how miserable the parents are, how miserable the child is. I mean, it's all driven by quality of life.
The number to call if you have a question this evening, 1-800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. The reverse side of this then, when is surgery necessary?
Surgery, as I said, is necessary if you find a blockage of the GI tract. Say, there's something called a pyloric stenosis, when the lower part of the stomach is kind of thickened and it needs to be opened up. And with laparoscopic advancement of pediatric surgery, this can be done easily. The surgeons will go through the belly button, make a small incision in the lower part of the stomach, and the problem is taken care of. There's also something called malrotation, where there's a kinking of the lower part, and which has a high risk of getting obstructed and creating a real life-threatening emergency. If we find that, that needs to be surgically taken care of. So apart from those surgical conditions, reflux can sometimes be really life-threatening, especially if it causes respiratory complication in little babies whose airway can be penetrated by the acid and can lead to something called apnea. So only thing is, we need to establish that the apnea is a true apnea and the life-threatening episode is a true life-threatening episode and happens on a recurrent basis. Many of these medication, when many of these babies, when they are being evaluated, they can be put on thickened formulas. The thickening of the formula helps a lot, so the milk doesn't pop back into the airway. Different medications, as well as positioning the baby, and maybe an apnea monitor, which is sometimes difficult to obtain, but it can be done through the system. Now, when all these systems fail, then surgery becomes necessary, and it could be a life-saving surgery. And this is when carefully done and after proper evaluation, it's a good thing to be done because it saves life.
Right.
But not overdoing it, because overdoing causes a lot of complication which could be avoided.
Okay. We've been talking about GERD primarily in infants. What are the symptoms and treatments for children that are older?
The older children is very different. Like, if you have kids over 5 years of age, they are having sort of, you know, spitting up episodes, vomiting, abdominal pain in around the chest, heartburn, having discomfort most of the time. Those will not easily go away if not properly treated. And in those cases, they need a proper medical evaluation. First time medical treatment could be tried with different medications, as I said, H2 antagonists to proton pump inhibitors, which is Zantac, Prilosec, Nexium. After the initial medical trial for about 4 to 6 weeks, if symptoms don't improve, then endoscopic evaluation is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to know what is causing the reflux. Over the last 15 years, we have realized that there are a number of conditions. Like, one is called eosinophilic esophagitis, which is an allergy-based reflux disease, which has a totally different treatment than standard reflux. And that can be only diagnosed histologically and by endoscopy. And once that is diagnosed, steroid treatment or dietary management with different exclusion diet is necessary. So I think a proper evaluation in older kids, because that's not going to go away easily, especially if it's a significant reflux disease, should be done.
All right. I'm going to get to a question about diet concerning that, since you just brought that up. But let me give the number one more time, 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. If you'd like to give us a call, if you have a question, we have Dr. Sunny Hussain, who's a pediatric gastroenterologist with Willis-Knighton Pediatric Gastroenterology and Research, also clinical associate professor of pediatrics for LSU Health Science Center in Shreveport. Carrie Gaskin is also joining us. She's a registered nurse and the clinical research manager at the Willis-Knighton Physician Network, and we've heard a little bit of the discussions of the current study going on. Primarily, we're talking about GERD in children. Make your call if you'd like at 800-552-8502. Now, you hinted that sometimes the treatment, or part of the treatment at least, concerns changing the diet. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
There are two kind of diet. In little babies whose main diet are milk, if they have significant reflux, we actually give them more hypoallergenic formula, which is kind of more broken down. We also learned in the recent past that reflux disease in babies, basically, there's an immunological basis to it. Like, say, babies are supposed to get breast milk. That's a human milk. Mm-hmm. But if we are not breastfeeding or not nursing, then they get formulas, which are basically cow's milk. And cow's milk protein intolerance is a known entity which basically causes a reaction in the GI tract, makes more acid, and makes the baby's reflux more. So if the reflux is not getting better with medication, which we at that point recommend hypoallergenic formulas, which are more broken down, where the protein is more broken down to peptides, and in more severe cases to amino acids, which are basically completely broken down and readily absorbable and hypoallergenic. But remember, when we go for these formulas which are broken down, the cost is very expensive, because there's a cost to break down these formulas. So we recommend that breast is the best. So nursing the baby is the best thing a mother can do to her baby. Now, for older kids who are over 5 years of age or the adults, I think that there's a general guideline is that avoid spicy food, avoid too much caffeinated drinks and products, and also avoid a particular food which bothers you. There's no guideline to a certain food. Like some folks, the sweet food or any dessert can trigger reflux disease. In certain individuals, spicy food does. So there's a general rule that if any particular food bothers you, I would try to avoid that.
One of the things that's often discussed nowadays is that there are a lot of children that tend to be obese, a lot of heavier kids. Is there a relationship between the acid reflux disease and obesity in children?
The obese children, if they are especially morbidly overweight, they have more incidence of hiatal hernia as well as gastroesophageal reflux disease. I mean, it's simple that they have more pressure in their inside their abdomen. Intra-abdominal pressure is high. So basically, there's more pressure upwards and more pressure on the stomach, which causes more reflux acid to happen. So obesity has definitely a link with chronic acid exposure. And so we highly recommend if an obese person is having reflux disease or gastritis, that weight reduction and diet therapy is fundamental.
Here's the number to call with your question this evening. This is Health Matters. Call us at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. When you treat a child who is overweight and they lose weight, does that tend to make the GERD go away, or is it also mixed in with other treatments as well?
There's no long-term study to or follow-up on that, but a general presumption will be that a weight reduction will definitely help with the reflux disease. I think one of the take-home message from today's talking point should be that The reflux in little babies and the reflux in older children and adults is a totally different ball game.
Mm-hmm.
Before we do anything drastic in little babies, either medically or surgically, we just need to think that 95% of these babies, they get better automatically with the help of nature or God. It's just our job as physicians and surgeons is to just do make a smooth transition, makes the baby symptom-free, so eventually they just can fly on their own. That's why I think a particular emphasis, again, I will put attention to Katie Gaskin, that if she could share her experience with the clinical trials she's doing with this new medication for reflux disease in babies. If Katie, you can say again a few words, what's your experience is?
Well, so far the babies are doing very well. I know when the 10 weeks are over, most of the babies want, or the parents want them to stay on the medication. Some of the advantages to the medication is the way it's administered. It's actually a capsule that we break into and we add it to something the patient's already taking, whether it be baby food or formula. So there's no extra mixing or having something custom-made and compounded at the pharmacy. The major goal with the drug study is to find out, number one, does it work? And number two, which dose is appropriate? And so that makes this a very unique study. Right now, the physicians are prescribing medications because there's nothing else out there. And with this one, we'll actually have some very definitive answers to be able to...
So how long does the study last?
It's actually only 10 weeks.
It's only 10 weeks.
10 weeks.
So what happens after that? What?
Well, a lot of it's driven by the physician.
Right.
You know, if the physician chooses to write the medication off-label, he can do that. I mean, most of the medications that patients are being treated with now, they're written off-label because, you know, this is a very unique study. There's no study that's ever been done like this to where a medication's been FDA approved for infants.
Mm-hmm. And I think we have another call that's coming in. So we're going to, let me give the phone number one more time, though. It's 800-552-8502. Call now if you have a question, especially if you're a parent and you have a question about your child. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. This is Beverly from Shreveport. Good evening to you. Go ahead with your question.
Yes, actually, I have a couple questions. One, has GERD ever been linked in infants to SIDS, the sudden infant death syndrome? And also, how do they find that this might be manifested in adults? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
There is a relationship with GERD and SIDS. If the acid can pop back in the esophagus or foot pipe and go to the respiratory tract, then it can cause a bronchospasm or spasm of your airway. And you can, especially the babies, can have a sudden infant death syndrome. The only tragic part is, I would say, that it's been blown out of proportion. And in many cases, say, the other factors, say, like passive smoking, feeding in an improper way, overfeeding, or even a viral respiratory tract infection, and can cause SIDS too. But at certain point, in the 80s, the reflux disease was thought as a major factor for sudden infant death syndrome. Subsequently, we have developed a lot of tools to study it. One is like a pH probe, where you have a little probe which can detect the acid in the stomach. And we put that probe at the head of a tube and put it in the lower part of the esophagus and check, how often a baby with a suspected SID apnea or apparent life-threatening episode refluxes. And there's also a study we have developed. It's called Milk Scan, where you can put a tagging material in the milk, give it to the baby, and see how often the milk can pop back or pops back in the esophagus. In many of the babies who are high risk for SIDS or has spitting up episodes or having apparent life-threatening episodes where they behave as if they have difficulty in breathing, reflux disease has not been identified as a major tool underlying disease. And with that knowledge, we have realized that we need to look for other factors, non-reflux associated factor for SIDS, although reflux should be carefully considered. Now, if there's a life-threatening episodes or of apnea, then maximum medical intervention should be done, and in some cases, the Nissen fundoplication is also necessary.
All right, the number to call to ask a question tonight on Health Matters, 1-800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. Just get back to school-age children just for a moment. In addition to the treatment, I'm assuming that the treatment then for school-age children is more similar to adults, so you're using some of the same medications, that type of thing. I mean, I've gone through GERD myself. I will admit to that, and it was very unpleasant. What advice do you have for parents or for the children themselves? Because they're going to school, they're doing their other activities, and they're having to suffer through this. What do you tell them to ease their pain?
If someone has symptomatic gastroesophageal reflux disease, that needs to be treated. Now, that can be done through over-the-counter medications. They are available nowadays, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. If that doesn't resolve, I think looking into your child's life, what they do, are they having some stress in the school, starting from homework to the social interaction, that needs to be explored. If those issues are not big factors, then I think at that point, most likely a medical appointment should be made with the primary care physician and see what else can be done, because the reflux school-age children should be having should be medically controllable, even with the over-the-counter medications in majority cases. Mm-hmm. If it is not, then probably it's kind of giving you some sign that it needs to be kind of evaluated more, especially if it becomes chronic. It may compromise with the school activity, education. You don't want that with your kids.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what's around over the horizon. And, of course, you're involved with the study that's going on now with this medication. What else is coming up that you're aware of? Anything new technology-wise for treatment?
Treatment-wise, I think we have moved from simple medications, which were like H2 antagonist, Zantac, Pepcid. We had before that Tagamet or Cimetidine. We have moved to a new arena, completely different, which is proton pump inhibitors. Now, we call it, in short, PPIs, which are the Prilosec, Nexium, the Acifex, which is our trial is about. This medication causes something called absolute achlorhydria, which means that it shuts down the proton pump, or the pump we have, molecular pump we have in the lining of the stomach, which makes hydrochloric acid. They kind of shut it down. Now, in reality, it is not 100% shutting down. It is probably almost 90%. So these are very effective medications. At this point, scientifically and from the pharmaceutical cutting edge, the efforts are being done to make these medications more effective and more biologically available and efficacious, I would say. Apart from proton pump inhibitors, there are some novel new medications are also being developed, which will improve the gastric barrier for acid. There's one medication which has been used for a long time. It's called sucralfate or carafate, which is often used to coat the stomach if the reflux disease or gastritis is intractable. So pretty much at this point, the most of the cutting-edge researches are happening with the proton pump inhibitors.
Okay, and the medication that you're working with mm-hmm. in the study, how does that particular medication work?
That is a PPI. That's a proton pump inhibitor. I think the difference is that effort has been made to make it administrable to little babies. Say, the most of these medications, which are now in the front line, the proton pump inhibitors, in short PPIs, mm-hmm. they are in capsules. So babies can't have capsules. So the little babies, they cannot sometimes swallow. So effort has been made, how can we make it more palatable for the little children? So the folks have come up with something called Solutab, which is a dissolvable tablet. The little kids take in their mouth and it dissolves. But how the little baby is going to do it?
Yeah.
Even if you give something dissolvable, if you put in the bottle, that may not be homogeneous. So you may not get the whole medication. So now most of the research has been happening how you can make it more available in the GI tract for the little children. That's the cutting edge research is all about right now.
Right. Okay. We do have a question from someone online. Let me give you the number one more time, 800-552-8502. Call with your question this evening. I'm joined by Dr. Sunny Hussain and also Carrie Gaskin, and we're discussing primarily gastroesophageal reflux disease. GERD, but other questions that might pertain to a pediatric gastroenterologist, I'm sure Dr. Hussain would welcome. Renee from Shreveport is on the line. Go ahead with your question.
Dr. Hussain, I know you're mostly discussing GERD today, but I was wanting to know if you could tell us some of the symptoms of Crohn's disease in infants.
Thank you, Renee, for asking the question. Crohn's disease is something very different. Crohn's disease is a severe form of a GI illness. It can affect any place from mouth to the bottom of the colon. And it's an immunological disease. We don't know why it happens, but you can get ulcers in your stomach. You can get inflammation of your colon. You can get abdominal pain, bleeding. You can throw up. So it's basically a challenge to treat, and the patients suffer a lot. Early diagnosis is important. And a treatment should be started immediately when the diagnosis is done.
A question about getting back to GERD. If an older child has GERD, or for that matter, an infant, if they have GERD at some point in their childhood, are they more likely to have it as an adult?
If they have a GERD as a baby, then there's no higher risk of having GERD rest of your life. But if a child has GERD after 1 year of age, mm-hmm. and if persist after 5 years, there's a high chance they will have some form of adult GERD in the remaining part of their life. It's interesting that under 12 months of age or before first year of life, if you have GERD, it doesn't matter. But if you develop late onset GERD or the GERD doesn't get better after your first birthday, then you will have some kind of consequences in your adult life.
All right. The number to call, 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. And we have, hope I'm pronouncing this right, Malice from Mansfield. Good evening. What's your question?
Hi.
Hey, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Hi, thanks for taking my question.
No problem.
My question is related to where GERD came from. Like, it's something that we're just hearing about in the last few years. I don't know if it's been around for a long time or it's newly diagnosed, and if it's something that's new, why are we hearing so much about it? Babies have been getting fed formula for a long time, but we never heard about them getting a reflux disease until recently. So where is that coming from?
This is coming from advancement of the medical science. I think part of the reason is there was no pediatric gastroenterology available even sort of 15 years ago. This specialty is a new specialty. Say, when we were little babies, we probably cried, we probably had to spit up, and we suffered as a baby, but we don't recall that. But our parents had a miserable time, and no one had an answer for that. But now, a couple of things have happened. With the advancement of pediatric gastroenterology, we have developed certain investigation tools, like one is X-ray, upper GI. We have developed gastric emptying scan, pH probe studies, and also endoscopy. And we have thoroughly studied that, and we have found answer for it. What we have found that babies don't have to cry. They don't have to be miserable, and their parents don't have to cry and wake up a whole night and have a poor quality of life, which made us understandable. There's an entity called reflux, which doesn't only exist in adult. It exists in younger children as well as in babies. And also we have realized that we can treat it. We don't have to suffer. I think that made the difference.
Well, how did physicians typically diagnose it then? I mean, what was their diagnosis when they encountered this?
The first thing we were doing is we were doing something called a pH probe, uh-huh. which we had like a sensor we would put in the stomach and study overnight. And subsequently, we did a number of other studies, including nuclear medical scan. But the major lead was provided by someone called Susan Orenstein in Pittsburgh. She's called the reflux queen. She is a professor of pediatric gastroenterology. She developed a questionnaire. She watched the little babies who has reflux, and she has developed a question criteria starting from spitting up, back arching, crying, throwing up or vomiting, and basically pretty much rendered pediatric reflux disease a clinical diagnosis. That's what we do nowadays. We have stopped doing too many investigations, endoscopies. We find that, I personally find most of them unnecessary. I think the reflux in little babies should be diagnosed clinically, and it could be easily treated. Now, in terms of the formulas, that's a good question. I think we should not be, this is my personal this recommendation, that prescribing expensive formulas starting from, you know, amino acid-based, peptide-based formula, which costs a lot of money, not to the parents only, also to the insurance providers. I personally believe that if we go back to breastfeeding and nursing, we will have much less incidence of reflux disease, not only in the number, also in terms of severity. We should go back to the basics. I think you're right. But the number has increased. The diagnosis has become more prominent. We talk about it more, as you say, because of the awareness of the new specialty and the knowledge, and also internet. If you go to internet and do a search on gastroesophageal refluxes, you will see that most of the reflux websites have been founded by the mothers whose babies have suffered badly from reflux disease, and they have created awareness. And subsequently, people have known about it. So that's what I would say.
The number to call, 800-552-8502. Just about 10 minutes left in this edition of Health Matters. If you'd like to get your question in, 800-552-8502. Another question related to diet, because the American diet, per se, is quite different than the diets in a lot of other places in the world. Is there a higher tendency towards GERD in our country? Is there no relation to that, or are there places in the world that it is virtually unseen?
The diet, in my opinion, as a whole, the specialist opinion, has a factor, but it becomes a crucial factor when it becomes a too spicy diet, or a diet which causes you obesity. Otherwise, I think lifestyle has more implication than diet itself in causing reflux.
How specifically?
If the kids go through stress, we often think that, why would a kid have a stress? But they do have a lot of stress. They have stress in the school, starting from homework, and growing as a kid with other kids, having a puberty, having sibling rivalry, friend issues, text messages. You know, a lot of things can cause a lot of stress, and they basically can produce increased acid in your stomach and cause subsequently reflux. So lifestyle is a very important thing, as well as diet.
All right, our next caller is Jennifer from Shreveport. Good evening, Jennifer. Go ahead with your question.
Good evening. I came into your show a little late, so I apologize if y'all have already covered this. I wondered if any long-term studies have been done on people taking PPIs long-term, and if there are any side effects to taking it long-term, or if its effectiveness decreases over time.
Wow, wonderful. You must be driving, Jennifer, right?
I am. I apologize.
No, where are you?
I am headed out of Shreveport toward my house.
Oh, listen, yes, long-term Prevacid and PPIs do have some issues which are coming in limelight now. We did not know about it, but we came to know about it where the Prevacid and Prilosec has been used as a long-term in institutions like where the patients with disability or elderly patients or nursing home, and that kind of situation. However, we haven't found them to be life-threatening or kind of, you know, something alarming. One of the major thing is, if you take it over, say, 5 years or 10 years, then bone metabolism and the calcium absorption could be impaired. So anyone who is taking Prevacid or Prilosec for more than 5 years should be a little worried about bone growth, especially if you're elderly and you're worried about osteoporosis. And as you know, with age, the bone density kind of, you know, wears out. So that's the main issue, which we are now investigating it. And there has been research funding to investigate it further. The other thing is long-term Prilosec, Nexium, or all those PPIs, because they suppress the acid too much, there's an increased theoretical chance of getting more GI infections. So these are the two major kind of concerns we have with long-term proton pump inhibitors.
What are the, for those children that undergo the surgery, what are the side effects or the problems associated with that?
The some babies or children don't have any. They do well, but if you look into the main mechanism of surgery, that you put a stitch on the top of the stomach or fundus of the stomach in 360 degrees so you cannot vomit anymore. It is done kind of as a life-saving measure or so you cannot have any reflux. But we all need to burp physiologically so we can basically have some eructation or basically have a normal stomach motility. Now, when you have a stitch or the Nissen fundoplication, that normal stomach movement is impaired. You develop something called a dysmotility, and you have to get used to it. Now, babies cannot speak, so we don't know what they go through. But adults, they have come to us that they have bad retching. Many of them, they feel bloated all the time because the stomach capacity goes down. They have dysmotility. And these are difficult to treat because this is a permanent surgery. Mm-hmm. And once it's done, it's done. So if it has to be done, there's no other way out. It needs to be done as a life-saving surgery or a surgery which improves the quality of your life. But the parents or the patient should be given all the risk-benefit ratio, the pros and cons of the surgery, and they should be educated that this is what you're going to get. You will get better in terms of reflux, but you will also have some consequences.
Right.
Once that informed consent has been obtained and the patients have given enough prior information, then basically we won't have the frustrations many patients have, like the caller we had earlier.
Mm-hmm. We have about 5 minutes or so to take your call. If you still have a question, give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That is 800-552-8502. With your question this evening, my guests are Dr. Sunny Hussain, who's a pediatric gastroenterologist, also Carrie Gaskin, who is an RN and the clinical research manager at the Willis-Knighton Physician Network. Call now at 800-552-8502. Why don't you talk just a little bit more, return to the study that you have going on, since that's new and on the horizon.
This is what particularly very impressive what Willis-Knighton Health System has done. They have set up this clinical trial center, which Carrie Gaskin heads as a director, and they have cut a lot of the red tapes if you want to do a clinical study anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
IRB approval, ensuring the safety issues, follow all the compliance and the regulations, not only locally, also not only the state-based, also the federal regulations you have to follow. I have done studies a lot. I was a scientist at National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. I have done stem cell studies. I've been a faculty at George Washington. Personally, I have never seen a place where research can be done so smoothly. And the parents don't feel like they're being used as an instrument or a guinea pig. Carrie Gaskin has done this study, which is and also we have Sherry Hazard, who is also a clinical coordinator. With this reflux study, they have handled it very well. And I think it will be, I would personally ask the parents who have been very frustrated with the medical treatment of your children with reflux disease, especially the babies, to give us a call at 318-212-5858. If you have any question, you can ask for personally me or Carrie Gaskin or Sherry Hazard to talk about it. And if Carrie has anything to add, please go ahead and add.
Well, just the purpose of all of our clinical trials is to give patients another alternative therapy. A lot of times it's when everything else has been exhausted and there's no other alternatives out there. They can go into a clinical trial and, you know, potentially get some benefit obviously we can't bear, you know, guarantee them they will benefit from a study, but if it doesn't help them, it may help somebody else with that condition at some point in time. And so that's what we tell all of our parents and our patients when they go into a trial, go into it with an open mind. Hopefully you'll get some benefit, but if not, you know, it could help the science and someone else may not have to suffer as you've suffered.
What's the number again if people have questions?
318-212-5858.
All right. We have just about a minute or two left here. You can call us at 800-552-8502 if you want to get in one last minute question. You're welcome to do that on today's Health Matters. Is there anything else that you feel that we haven't covered yet?
I think we covered very well. And personally, on behalf of the medical community in Shreveport and Bossier, I wanted to thank you, Mr. Kermit Poling, Renee Moran, and the Red River Radio, and also LSU as a whole, that you do a wonderful job doing all these beautiful programs, and especially the Health Matters. It means a lot. Thank you so much.
Well, we appreciate that. Oh, one question that did come online. Is there a website with more information?
Yes, it's www.wkpnresearch.com.
All right. Well, Dr. Sunny Hussain, Carrie Gaskin, I want to thank you both for being here for tonight's Health Matters. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should, of course, consult your physician or a health professional. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. The program is engineered by Bill Beckett with assistance from Wally Derleth and Travis Stewart. I'm your host, Kermit Poling. Thank you for joining us this evening. This is member-supported Red River Radio, a public radio service of LSUS.